We are back. Welcome to 20VC with me, Harry Stebbingson. What a show we have for you today. In the hot seat, one of the biggest capital deployers in the market with over $30 billion in capital commitments and over 400 portfolio companies. They are one of the leading investing franchises of the last 25 years. And so with that, I'm thrilled to welcome Devon Parrock, Managing Director at Insight Partners, where Devon himself has made more than 90 investments, including in the likes of, check this out, Twitter, Alibaba, JD.com, ChargeBee, Vinted and Automattic, the makers of WordPress, to name a few. Devon also sits on the boards of Checkout, where we had Guillaume on the show just last month, Calm, Saks.com, Optimizely, and First Dibs, again to name a few. And if that wasn't enough, Devon also sits on the boards of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and one that's very close to my heart, in the board of the Tisch New York MS Research Center, with my mum obviously having multiple cirrhosis. Really meaningful one for me there. As a result of his investing success, though, Devon's also been named on the Forbes Midas list no less than 5 times. And I do want to say a huge thank you to Guillaume at Checkout, Jeff Lieberman and Thomas at Vinted for some amazing question suggestions today. Really did make such a difference.
But before we dive into the show today, did you know that more than 80% of US public stock is owned by just 10% of Americans? This divide is even greater in the private markets. Carter makes it as easy to issue equity to your employees as it is to issue payroll, and for employees, as easy to accept it too. More than 16,000 companies issue equity to their employees through Carter. Whether you're just getting started or getting ready to go public, the team at Carter can help. Check them out at Carter.com. And then another incredible product you have to introduce is SecureFrame. SecureFrame helps companies get enterprise ready by streamlining SOC 2 and ISO 27001 compliance. SecureFrame allows companies to get compliant within weeks rather than the painful months that is today. Join companies like Stream, Hasura, Benepass, and unlock more sales with SecureFrame. And 20VC listeners get 10% off at SecureFrame.com/20VC. And finally, I've always been a big history fan, and so I want to talk about Cooley, the global law firm built around startups and venture capital. Since forming the very first venture fund in Silicon Valley, Cooley's formed more venture capital funds than any other law firm in the world, with 50 plus years working with VCs. They help VCs form and manage funds, make investments, and handle the myriad of issues that arise throughout a fund's lifetime. So to learn more about the number one most active law firm representing VC-backed companies going public, head over to Cooley.com and also check out CooleyGo.com.
But enough of me. So now I'm thrilled to welcome Devon Parrock, Managing Director at Insight Partners.
3, 2, 1, 0. You have now arrived at your destination.
Devon, this is such a joy to do. The last time we met, we were in London. I'm sad we can't be in person, but thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. I think you were drinking an espresso martini, if I remember correctly. So I hope you're still enjoying those.
You have a great memory. And yeah, I mean, sadly, I'm more on espressos these days, but totally good memory. But I do want to start, you know, you joined Insight over 21 years ago. Talk to me, how did you make your way into the world of kind of venture and finance? And how did you come to be at Insight first? Let's start with some context.
Well, yeah, no, this is not where I expected to be. I mean, I was a science geek in high school, went to the International Science Fair, went to Penn, was studying biochemistry. And like what happens a lot, serendipity happens. And I had a bunch of roommates that were economics majors and said, well, I guess I should take a class in economics. So I was doing research at the medical school at Penn while I was taking a class in econ. I really enjoyed the econ class. And so while I stuck with biochemistry as my major, I got a job on Wall Street after my freshman year and really liked that. And I came back my sophomore year and went back to science. And I kept kind of going back and forth. And then I kind of had to make a decision, and I decided I was going to do both. I was going to study economics and biochemistry. And then after, I think, a semester where I took 7 classes to try to meet the requirements for both, I decided that probably wasn't such a great idea. And I had to make a decision. And people say, well, how'd you decide to do economics, which is what I decided to do? And I think, honestly, it was impatience, which is I didn't see myself in school for how long it was going to take to be a doctor. 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school, residency. And I figured, well, if I go into business, I can start quickly. And I wish I could give a better answer, but I really do believe it was my impatience that led me to end up majoring in economics. And I went to Blackstone out of college. And then I had an opportunity to join a merchant banking boutique, what was then called at the time Barron's & Manilow & Company, which was founded by the former co-heads of merchant banking and Merrill Lynch. A few years in, they decided that they wanted to do something in tech. They brought a few people on, and effectively what our role was going to be was to help them raise a fund, and we're going to invest in technology. That person really was Jeff Waring and Jerry Murdoch, who ended up being the founders of Insight. Jeff and Jerry quickly figured out that Barron's & Manilow wasn't really going to add a lot of value in a tech fund, and they decided to go off on their own. I built a good relationship with them and had worked on a few deals with them, and they said, why don't you join us? I, thinking I was a hotshot vice president, you know, at the age of 25, and they were two people without a fund, didn't seem like a really good decision. So I decided, no, I think I'm going to stay, but you guys should go do this, which they did. And thankfully, we stayed in touch, and Jeff and I had lunch in 1999. He was like, well, we're about to raise our first institutional fund. Maybe you should join us now. And that's when I joined. That's how I got to Insight.
I mean, I absolutely love it. And what a 21 years it has been. I do want to ask it because, you know, I've never seen a macro crash. We've had the most wonderful bull market for the last however many years. You know, you've seen two very prominently, you know, one very close after you were joining Insight, and then obviously in 2008. How did seeing those crashes impact your investing mentality today, do you think?
Yeah, and interestingly, there's been a third that we all just lived through, which is COVID, which was an economic effect, even if we didn't see it in the stock market. If you look at those three, I think they were very, very different. Back in 1999, you had high stock market valuations, but you had a lot of companies that weren't really companies. You know, 2000, while you had a massive contraction, a lot of the contraction was businesses didn't really have a model. And when the tide came in, it was clear they didn't have a model. And so you saw a lot of those companies never make it. 2008, you saw a very significant economic contraction, but you had companies that were real companies. And while they had to make radical changes in their business and cut expenses and do all those things, generally what you find is software was still pretty resilient and it kind of came back. And then the last one, which was in some ways the most interesting one, which we all got, certainly I and others got pretty wrong, was COVID, where we all met with our LPs. We said, you know, we're probably not going to deploy any capital. Valuations are going to go down dramatically. Get ready for probably our worst performance in a really long time. And of course, none of that came true. And I think that one of the things that many of us learned through that is software, even though we're obviously big believers in the software model, it turns out that it's even better than we thought it was, that it was even more resilient than we thought it was. And that COVID accelerated, obviously, the digital transformation trends that have been going on for a really, really long time. So I kind of come out of this, and the big picture that I take out of those three different economic dislocations is that when you have real companies, which, as I said, in 1999, 2000, you had less real companies, the software model is incredibly resilient. I feel better about that, having been through those three periods, than I probably did before.
I totally agree with you in those respects, and especially in terms of the resiliency of the software model. I think, you know, the challenge is everyone is now seeing it, from big macro funds to crossover funds, and the venture world has changed so much in the last year alone. You know, we've seen Tiger deploy $5 billion in 3 months, which is, I mean, blimey, it's faster than the 20-minute VC episode. And so my question to you is, like, when you look at the current landscape, how do you, with your Insight hat on, how do you analyze the current kind of mania that we see in the market?
Well, a couple of things. One, let's step back to the highest level and think about the macro. And I think a lot of people are of the same view that I think I just shared, which is that the software model is incredibly resilient. Even with the amount of growth we've had over the last 10 or 20 years, you know, only 20% of loads, as an example, are in the cloud, right? So there's still a long way to go. And I think people see another 10 to 20 years of growth. Two, I think growth has actually accelerated. If you look at our kind of median growth rate in our funds, you know, fund five, fund six, fund seven, fund eight, as you get to each successive fund, the median growth rate is higher. And that's with bigger funds. And so I think people are seeing the rate of acceleration increase. They're saying the digital transformation trends are happening even faster, and the rate of innovation is really faster. So I think generally when it comes to, because really your question when it comes down to it is really a question about the valuation world. We have a line that we use internally is that we never overpay, companies miss their numbers. What it really is saying, if we're right on our growth underwriting, price is not really the problem, because it's amazing the power of compounding. If you take, and I'm going to use low numbers, but if you take a 10% growth rate over 15 years, the company 6Xs. If you take a 15% growth rate over the same period of time, the company 16Xs. And generally in our spaces, we're talking about companies that are growing at 50, 60, 70%. So I think that what we've seen over the last 3 or 4 years is that companies have generally been able to meet or exceed our growth expectations. And if they can continue to do that, valuations, while they've gone up, you can still justify them.
They have over the years. I guess my question is, we're seeing it now like never before, where I'm quite often seeing 5 to 10 million ARR companies be $1.5 billion in valuation. And I'm just scratching my head going, I don't want to be pessimistic. I want to see the brilliance, but I can't see this growing into the valuation at the rate it needs to. Do you think we are going to see this kind of dislocation in the next few years? Or do you think actually they will grow into it?
I think there was a company we were just talking about internally this week that we're looking at that I think has 4 million of ARR that went for $1.5 billion valuation with, you know, well-known funds. Look, I think that are every one of those deals going to work? No. But the converse is also true. Like when we do our analysis of the deals that worked and the deals that didn't work, we often find is when we did something that we thought was cheap, those didn't work particularly well either. And I think that where we've generally had misses, they've been more because we said no on valuation and the company actually executed incredibly well at a very, very large market. So I'm not going to sit here and tell you that every company that raises money at a $1.5 billion valuation of $4 million of ARR is going to work, but you're going to have a subset that are definitely going to work. Our job is to make sure that we're getting in the right ones, and that the ones that we're paying up for are the ones where our long-term growth underwriting is correct. And we won't always be correct, obviously, but we need to be correct enough.
Can I ask a really interesting one? I had a chat yesterday with one of the best funds in the world, and they said the way that they determine ultimate success is how much market share of unicorn companies do they have. So of the total available market of unicorn companies, they want to have north of 25% in their portfolios. How do you ultimately define like insight and your success? Is there one of those kind of meta questions which is the guiding North Star?
Look, ultimately, obviously, we measure ourselves by what our LPs measure us by, which is by having good returns, which we've been fortunate enough to have had. But what the person you spoke to yesterday said is another way of saying the same thing, meaning if you actually have a high market share in kind of unicorn companies, which, by the way, I don't think we do. And that's why I think our market opportunities is so large, which is that our market share in unicorn companies isn't that high relative to what I think it could be. In many cases, companies that we looked at and decided not to pursue, which means we have to get better as a firm on how we get comfortable with deals like that. But I think those things are related, right? So how do you get the best returns in this space? It's by being in the best companies. And when you're in the best companies, price generally didn't end up really mattering that much. Of course, you'd always rather own something cheaper, but generally there's a clearing price. And the decision point isn't whether you'd like to do the deal at a lower price. Of course, you'd rather do the deal at the lower price, but we're not in a market where that's possible. I think the bigger challenge today, to be honest with you, Harry, is less around price. It's more on how quickly decisions are having to get made. And I think that, I think, might have, you know, negative implications, not just for investors, but also for founders, because these deals are marriages. You're in these companies with people for a long period of time. I'm more troubled by having to not necessarily pay a price. I'm more troubled by having to make that decision over a weekend or in 3 days without having spent a meaningful amount of time. And even if that time's not in person, oftentimes you're seeing these decisions get made after a half hour, an hour Zoom. That concerns me more because I think we all feel it at every stage. I don't think that matters whether you're at seed or you're at pre-IPO round. Those decisions are getting made really, really quickly. And I think in some ways, at an earlier stage, it's even more important to spend that time because you're really betting on the person. You're not betting on a set of financial metrics, which we can do in a later stage company.
Can I ask, you know, when you think about that kind of compression in terms of time frame and apply it across the portfolio, I was always taught, and I'm a student of venture, temporal diversification is important and the benefits of it. It seems like that's kind of been thrown out the window. How do you think about temporal diversification, the benefits of it, and whether it's still such an important factor today than it was years ago?
Look, I mean, I think it's hard to argue. I remember when I was at Blackstone, I was an analyst. We had done an analysis of what were the biggest drivers of our returns. It wasn't done by me. It was just done as a firm-wide exercise, and I was just part of it. But it was just interesting to see that one of the most important drivers was the year you did the deal, because cycle of time mattered, right? If you bought at a time when prices were low and you sold at a time when prices were higher. So there's no doubt timing matters. That being said, it's interesting, right? If you go back to, you talked about 1999, you talked about 2008, 2007. At that point in time, you know, we were investing slowly. And investors said, hey, guys, you're investing fast now. How come you invested slow during that period? The reality is people slowed down. The companies slowed down raising capital because they saw the valuations contract. And it wasn't like there were so many deals to go do. And so while, of course, you'd like to do temporal diversification, and of course, ideally, your temporal diversification would be such that when prices are low, you're deploying the most amount of capital. But those aren't the times when companies go raise capital or not significant amounts of capital. And so I think what you are seeing generally, I mean, we probably deploy funds in about 2.5 years. 5 or 7 years ago, we were perceived as being extremely fast because we deployed in 2.5 years. And LPs were like, you guys come back too quickly. And I think we're probably now average in 2.5 years. And there's certainly a lot of firms that are coming back even sooner. The challenge is, as deployment paces have gone up, if you try to get temporal diversification defined as 3 or 4 years, fund sizes would be even dramatically larger than they are now. You know, which also LPs would say, hey, like, I don't really want you to have a, you know, $30 billion fund to have 4 years of temporal diversification, right? So I think that the economics for LPs, if they end up with four-year diversification at these types of deployment cases, the fee drag gets pretty high as well. So I think we're just in a market where temporal diversification is probably going to get defined as 2.5 years, and some funds a lot lower. But, you know, in the market overall, it's probably more like 2 to 2.5 years. I mean, that's kind of where the market is right now.
We've mentioned price quite a few times, and I spoke to Jeff before the show, and he said one of the most brilliant skills that Devin has is his ability to negotiate. And so I thought that's such an interesting thing. He said it's like your single biggest strength. So what do you think makes you such a good negotiator? And when you think about like the art of negotiation, what do you think its core essence is?
Well, I think that people, unfortunately, they view negotiating as a game. And I don't really think it's a game. I think negotiation that works, to me, is one where you actually build a trust-based relationship with somebody, that they believe that what you're saying is true, that you believe what they're saying is true. You both have certain needs to satisfy your constituency. In my case, it can be my investment committee. In their case, it can be their co-founders or their company or whatever it might be. There's things that are important to them and there's things that are important to us. And I think in a good negotiation, you're actually sensitive to what you need, but you're also very sensitive to what they need. You try to bridge that gap and you try to bridge it in a way that's honest. And I think people feel like, oh, in order to negotiate, you have to have this brinksmanship style. Actually, honestly, don't think that works. And I think that, you know, I've done multiple deals on a handshake. I mean, you've talked to Guy at checkout. I mean, we did that deal on a handshake. We never signed a term sheet. I knew what was important to him. He knew what was important to us. We shook hands. And, you know, my view was, and I'm going to say this, everybody's going to say, let's do term sheets via handshake. But if the handshake's not good enough, maybe I don't want to invest. And so I think the key in a negotiation is making sure both sides really understand what's important to the other party. And everybody should walk away feeling like they got something. I think negotiations where one party feels like they got everything and the other side got nothing, those just generally don't work. And then the last one is be honest. I mean, how many times I've been in a situation where there's an advisor or there's a banker and they say, oh, we're not going to do a deal for a penny less than, you know, X. And you're like, okay, well, you know, then I'm out. And then you hear the deal get done at a substantially lower valuation 2 weeks later. Well, that didn't serve anybody that well. Like, we might have done the deal at that price. The company might have wanted us as an investor. So I think if you're transparent, honest, and you really try hard to understand what the other person wants, I mean, I think that actually ends up being how a good negotiation gets done.
It's really interesting you say about kind of knowing what each party wants. I had David Tisch on the show from Box Group the other day.
I listened to it. It was a great interview.
Thank you so much. And he said in the episode, like, the entrepreneur doesn't need to know my ownership requirements. They don't need to know that. And actually, if you're in the best companies, it doesn't matter. And so that's nothing to do with them. And I want to remove that from their plate. I'm intrigued on that element of ownership, because it's a very different stage also for you versus Box.
Yeah.
How do you think about the importance of ownership today? A lot of people are going, well, markets are 10x bigger, so we don't need the ownership that we did before. How do you think about the centrality of ownership when you're investing today, Devin?
Once we decided we like something, we like to own as much as we can. That being said, we don't have like a minimum threshold. We don't have a minimum percentage we have to own. You know, we have companies where we own as little as 3-4%, and we have companies where we own north of 90%. One of the things that's different about us is that we're willing to, as you know, we also have like a buyout business where we do kind of full control transactions where we use leverage. But I think what's less known is that we also do control deals where we're buying control of companies that you would define as a venture company, where a set of existing investors, for whatever set of reasons, wants to get liquidity. And we're excited about the growth profile of the company. They don't need to be profitable. We'll go buy control. So we own 70 and 80% of companies that if I just showed you the income statement, you'd say, well, that looks like a venture company. That doesn't look like a buyout. And you'd be right. And we wouldn't be using any leverage. We would do an all kind of equity deal. So we come at it as once we build conviction on something, we want to own as much as we can. That being said, if you've got an asset that's growing 100% a year as a seller, you might decide that selling 80% of that doesn't make sense because the value is going up too quickly. So our view is, look, we'll get on the cap table. And if at any time you're interested in selling more, we're here and we're open to buy more, whether that be for secondary or whether that be for capital in the company or to potentially finance additional M&A.
Can I ask a tough one, which is like, you know, I've spoken to founders before who have offers from inside and they say one amazing, obviously, and very excited, but one concern is the signaling risk. Given your ability to invest across stage, it's what if they don't invest next round and how is that perceived? How do you advise and answer that question with the Insight hat on?
The reality is the markets, I think David talked about this in his interview, right? I mean, I think the market has shown that the signaling risk is not that significant of a risk, that is entirely possible for us to invest in something earlier, for us to not pursue the next round, or for the company still to be able to raise capital. As a practical matter in our case, it hasn't happened very often. We don't think of ourselves in an early stage fund. So if we're going into something on the earlier phase, we have pretty strong conviction. And generally, when the company is raising that next round, it's very rare that there's a sufficient amount of data where you're ready to say, oh, I liked it 6 months ago. I really don't like it now. Generally, there's been progress, but there hasn't been enough progress for you or not progress for you to make the decision to not continue to support the company. So I'll answer the question in a theoretical sense. It hasn't proven to be a big issue in the market more broadly. Certainly hasn't been that big an issue in our portfolio because it's not been very common for us to not continue to support the company.
I mean, in terms of supporting supporting the company. We mentioned Guy at checkout. I also spoke to Thomas at Vinted. One area where obviously you're very instrumental in supporting the companies is on boards. You know, you've sat on countless boards now. I'd love your thoughts on, like, how do you think about your style of board membership and how has that changed over the years, Devin?
I still remember one of my first boards back in 2002, maybe. I was with my wife. We were visiting schools for my son for pre-kindergarten, which of course in New York is like you're applying to Harvard. And the rule is when you're going on your school interview, you can't look at your phone, you can't do anything. And I got a call from the CEO of this company I was on the board of saying, I think CIO was quitting. I still remember the feeling I had because it's one of my first boards. I just thought it was a total disaster. I was like emotionally just wrecked by this. My wife was glaring at me saying to put my phone away, which I did. Thankfully, my son got in. And one of the things you realize is that companies have lots of ups and downs and you can't get that affected by individual ups and downs. So early on, I think I probably overreacted to the negative and probably overreacted to the positive. So I think the biggest thing for all those years is you kind of get a little bit more even keeled about both bad news and good news. And you realize every company, even the most successful company, is going to have bumps. You generally work through them and you have confidence in your team. So that's one. Number two, I think when you're early on, you sometimes forget that you're a board member. You're not an operator. You're not there to run the company. You're there to help. You're there to be a devil's advocate. You're there to challenge thinking. But at the end of the day, you're there to support the management team. And I think early on, you're so focused on that deal working. You feel the pressure of that deal working that sometimes you go into the operating side unintentionally because you feel like this has to work. And I think as you do this longer, you realize that's really not your role. By the way, you're probably not, I'll speak for myself, I'm not going to add value telling a company how to operate. But I think I can add value because a lot of pattern recognition of being a devil's advocate, saying, hey, this has worked somewhere else. Maybe you want to talk to this company, or maybe you should take a little bit more risk, or maybe you should take a little less risk. And so I think kind of playing at that strategic level is really what I think a good board member does. And then the last thing is, you know, try to lean into the things where you can really add value. I think there's a tendency early on to feel like you have to have an opinion on everything. Now, again, I'll speak for myself. That was a weakness. I felt like I had to have an opinion on everything. And I don't feel that way anymore. I know the areas that I think I can add value and I push on those, and where I can't, there's other board members and other people who are going to add more value than me.
Can I ask, on the flip side of that, if that's like the board member side, on the founder side, you've worked with some of the best founders over the last decade. How do the very best founders run their board meetings? And I guess, what do they do to extract the most value from them, from your perspective?
That's a great question, because I'm still on many boards and board meetings. There are still definitely board meetings I look forward to. I won't name companies now. And board meetings I really don't look forward to. And to me, the board meetings I don't look forward to, I talk about a profile of a board meeting, is kind of a recitation of facts. What I say to people is, I like to read history for fun, but I don't like people reading the history. So the board meetings I enjoy the most, where I have enough influence to be able to do this, I've broken up the board meeting into two separate board meetings. So one's a 45-minute financial overview of performance, where the CFO just presents the financial performance. People have any questions, they can ask. And then the main board meeting, where there's one slide on financial performance. But then the rest of the meeting is really about highlights and lowlights, what's working, what's not working, generally having one or two functional areas come in and present so that you get better exposure to the rest of the management team. And then kind of what are the key strategic issues that the CEO is kind of focused on. And those are my favorite board meetings. I also think that long board meetings tend to lead to recitation of facts, and tighter board meetings tend to focus the conversation on the things that matter.
One thing that I often think about is when you identify a core weakness or a core concern, especially related to the CEO or the founder's leadership, I'm never sure whether it's the right environment to air it openly in front of five other board members and really put the CEO on the spot, or to take them aside at the end and say, hey, Devin, I noticed this and we should think about this. How do you think about when's the right time to air those core concerns? Because you do also want to get the benefit of the wisdom of the people in the room.
Yeah, and I think it depends a little bit on kind of what it is, right? I mean, I think if it's something around, I don't feel like our marketing strategy is really working here. I'm just using an example. You know, that's something where getting broader kind of feedback where somebody else might have a different view and really airing it out probably has value. I think where it gets more sensitive is when you think there's a member of the senior management team that maybe is not working, who's a direct report of the CEO, or you have a challenge with the way the CEO might be handling something. I think those conversations are better had one-on-one. I think people tend to just think about ourselves. We tend to be defensive when people critique us in front of five people, and we tend to be less defensive when people talk to to us kind of one-on-one, or at least I do. And so I find that those conversations are much more kind of constructive and people are more open in a kind of one-on-one type conversation.
Speaking of the time on the board there, I do want to touch on time allocation across the portfolio, because like traditional thinking would suggest, hey, you spend all your time with the winners, that's what drives the returns. And bluntly, you minimize time on underperforming companies just in terms of how you're going to optimize fund performance. How do you think about time allocation across the portfolio? Have there been any big lessons for you from the 21 years now?
Yeah, I mean, you missed the category, which is that you've got clear winners, you've got the middle, which are meaningful for the fund performance, and then you've got the ones that are going to return capital or potentially lose money. How should people allocate? If you said, I'm a robot and I'm going to allocate my time in a way that totally optimizes fund returns, actually you spend almost no time with the winners. The market's great, the management's great, you're a cheerleader. You're not adding as much value as you think you are. The middle, you actually probably can influence the outcome. Maybe it requires making some changes in the strategy, maybe it requires upgrading the management team, but there's probably ways that you can influence that outcome. So spending some meaningful time in the middle actually makes sense. And then spending almost no time on the capital returners or the losers. That's how an optimized machine would spend their time. I don't know of anybody who's actually spends their time that way, and I certainly don't. Why? Well, one, spending time with winners is a lot cheaper than therapy. We spend a lot of time looking for companies. It feels good to be around companies that are doing great, even if you're not adding a lot of value. And I don't know a single investor who doesn't want to spend time with their winners, even if they're not adding value. We probably don't spend enough time with the middle, and we end up spending a lot of time with the bottom. So while that's not theoretically or hypothetically the right allocation of time, I'm not sure I would radically change it. So that's probably where I am in the second description. I do force myself to spend more time, call it in the middle, which is the bulk of the companies. But the bottom, I feel like entrepreneurs have killed themselves to raise this capital, to go after this market. And partially it's probably personal ego, if not wanting to lose, but also like just feeling like you can't really abandon somebody. I think if you think about this from a long-term perspective, and I'm not saying people should spend a disproportionate time there, but I think, you know, when you want to be referenced long-term, I think you want to be referenced as somebody who, when there was a problem, you didn't abandon ship. I think there's a way to manage your time, obviously, and not spend a crazy amount of time there. But I don't think I'll ever get to the point where I'm like, oh, well, that's clearly not a deal that's working. I'm not going to spend any time.
Can I ask, speaking of those companies that maybe don't perform as well, I do have to ask this, and I hope it's not too personal, but you know, 21 years, huge successes. There's very little that you haven't seen. When you think about like your own insecurities and self-doubts today.
I think there's a term, right? Insecure overachiever. I definitely go into that bucket. I mean, look, I think that I constantly am worried about, am I going to be able to still find companies that are going to perform really, really well? And look, when you want to learn how to get better at tennis, you play with people who are better than you. And I think one of the great things about Insight, all my partners are amazing investors. And it's a firm where there's so many people who are doing amazing deals. And I constantly feel the pressure to keep up with them. I think that's a healthy thing. It's a good thing. But I think that it definitely keeps me on my toes because I feel like, okay, well, Jeff Waring just took that one public at this massive valuation and Jeff Lieberman just sold this thing. And like, I got to find something just as good. And I think that I won't name people, but I've talked to people at other funds who are really well-known names. I mean, way better known names than me who had the same concern about, can they keep up? Can they continue to find great deals? It's not easy to do, right? So we all have to work hard. I think that being said, while it's not a great feeling to have that feeling, I also think it is the thing that keeps you going and keeps you motivated and keeps you working hard.
Totally. It does keep you going. You mentioned that, you know, Jeff taking companies public and, you know, as we mentioned, some of the amazing successes you and the firm have had. One big question I always have is like, how do you prevent past successes or failures impacting your future decision making? And I guess with the many IPOs that you've had, a certain space or vertical can inherently seem more attractive than others because you've seen how good it can be. How do you prevent past impacting future decision making?
Well, for one, if you sat in on our partners meetings, or we had a first in-person outdoor lunch, I guess, of our investment committee earlier this week, you would not come out of lunch feeling like, boy, these guys know how to celebrate. We spend way more of our time beating ourselves up on the things that we missed and why didn't we look at that area, or are we not being aggressive enough in that area, or why didn't we do that deal when we saw it? So I think the first thing is you constantly have to focus on the things you can do better rather than celebrating the successes. I can tell you that's very much of our culture. And there's emails that go around when a deal gets announced and we talk about, do we look at it? Do we spend enough time on it? Who won it? What did they see that we didn't see? We do a lot of that. And so I think that part of it is, what's the culture? Everybody loves what they do and everybody really wants to win. If you talk to anyone who's a competitive athlete, what do? They watch videos of their competition. They see what the competition's doing. They try to learn from what they're doing. How are they going to compete against that? That's what we do. We don't watch videos, obviously, but we spend a lot of time studying what others are doing and where we can learn from it.
When firms scale, inherently, even if you want like a meritocracy of ideas, hierarchies are created and people have different weight of words. I think, you know, the weight of your words are very impactful. Yeah. How do you ensure that everyone feels a safe space where even an analyst can say, hey, Devin, I think you're wrong on this one and we've missed out? How do you think about creating that environment of safety and preventing words being too heavy from certain people?
Look, it gets harder and harder as the firm gets kind of bigger and bigger, but I'll tell you what I do. And so when I'm working on a deal, we have a team generally of people who are working on it, people from our on-site team. I think people don't always understand that like our firm, the way it works is really a team-based approach. So when we're looking at a new investment, there's members of the investment team. We have our on-site team, which is kind of our consulting slash operations team. And we all do that diligence process together. We generally have a meeting before we decide whether we're going to do something, where we kind of talk about the diligence findings. And my approach on those is always to start with the most junior person and go to the most senior person, as opposed to start with the most senior person and go the other way. I mean, you have the most junior person speak first. Now, they don't like to be the first person to speak because they don't know where the rest of the room is. But I think it's really important, because if I or another senior person says, I love this deal, or this deal's great, they may think they hate the deal, or there's something they found in diligence that they're concerned about. So you kind of need to let the junior folks speak first so that you make sure that they're able to. And oftentimes they might have done the customer calls. They might have done the references. They might have done some really, really important fundamental work. And you want to make sure that you kind of hear that. We were talking about this earlier with respect to pace. You know, the decision-making pace has gotten so quick, it's harder and harder to create processes to make sure that you get that data and you kind of incorporate it into your decision.
Listen, I love that in terms of them speaking first. It reminds me of Annie Duke on the show who wrote Thinking in Bets. She suggested that all ICs are done where you essentially actually document your thoughts beforehand. So the night before, you write out all your opinions and then you submit them, and then no one is impacted by external perspectives and you have the most pure conversations, which I really liked as a method.
Yeah.
I do want to move into my favorite though, Devin, which is the quick fire round. So I say a short statement and you give me your immediate thoughts. Does that sound okay?
Sounds great.
Okay, so what's the favorite book and why?
I read really, really, really widely. We're sitting in my kind of library here. So I don't have a favorite. Just as an example, just to show you the randomness of what I read, the last three books I read, one is What We Know About Climate Change by Kerry Emanuel, who's like a professor at MIT, because I don't feel like it's a topic I know enough about. It's got a little bit of a scientific tilt, but it's great because it's 50 pages, so anybody can read it really quickly, and it's a great summary of the topic. Before that, I read a book called The Book of Eels. Yes, eels as in the fish. By the way, it's a bestseller, and it's a book about the history of eels, which is fascinating, by the way, as well as the relationship of the author and his father. And then the one I'm reading right now is a book called On the Writing Process by John McPhee, who's been a 30-year writer at The New Yorker, and he's just talking about his process of how he writes. And I think writing is such an underrated skill, constantly trying to improve how I write. And so that's a fascinating book. Those are literally the last three books. So I read pretty widely, and I read on pretty eclectic topics.
Listen, I have not read the climate change book, so I think that's great. 50 pages sold. Book of writing, totally want to read that. The fact that you're reading a book on eels makes me think you should come to London and have an espresso martini with me. we'll resolve that in time, Devin. Tell me, you know, on appearance, you've achieved, you know, everything that one would want to. What motivates you today, Devin?
I just love to learn. I mean, that goes back to topic one. The beauty of this business that we're both in is there's always a new thing to learn about. There's always a new topic to learn about. And how long you've been doing it is totally irrelevant. The smartest person about cryptocurrency at Insight, 25. And if I want to learn about it, I have to go back to first principles and learn it as if I'm 25 too. And I love that. That's what motivates me.
What motto or quote do you most frequently revert back to?
It's an easy one. It's nothing worth having comes easy. And, you know, I've got kids, 18 and 21, and I tell them that. And I think it's true for founders. I think it's true for myself. I think we're in this world right now where everybody feels like things happen really quickly. I think I listened to one of your episodes, maybe it was First Round, talking about Roblox and how that was a 10-year fast journey. And everybody sees the end. And like people say, oh, Insight, you're so successful. You know, they forget Jeff Waring and Jerry Murdoch like in a station wagon running around trying to raise $30 million. And without that, it wouldn't be what it is today. So I think if it's worth having, you got to work at it. And it's not going to come easy. And I think there's a tendency in today's world to think that things are going to come easily, but they generally don't.
Absolutely. Chris called it the slow bake. But tell me, what's the biggest challenge for you stay with Insight?
I think it's a constant reinvention. You talked earlier about, like, say, what Tiger's doing. And, you know, 5 years from now, it'll be somebody else or something else or a different market shift. And I think it's continuing to evolve our business to the market opportunity. And I think we've done a reasonable job on that so far. But the markets are changing faster and faster, and making sure that we continue to change as fast and while maintaining, and this is really important, the entrepreneurial culture that we have. And I think that's probably the biggest challenge.
What do you know now that you wish you'd known at the start of your career in venture?
That you're never going to know the answer. I mean, I think there's a tendency to feel like with diligence, you can get to 100%. There is no 100%. And we were talking earlier about getting people's opinions. You know, one of my favorite things I do when I'm talking to people on my team and we're looking at a deal is I say, well, would you wire the money today? And they're like, well, but we haven't really done the customer calls yet. I'm like, right, we're not going to wire the money today. I just want to know, would you wire the money today? With no additional information, what would you do? And people hate that question. And it's my favorite question because it forces you to think of, okay, do we have enough information to make the decision? Because we're never going to have, we could always do another 5 customer calls. We could always talk to 5 more employees. But at some point you get to diminishing returns. Is that 80%? Is it 70%? Is it 60%? I don't know. But training people to think about making decisions with the information that you have when the information is not complete, including myself, by the way, is, I think, really important.
I have to ask this one. You just gave me too much there. How do you get comfortable with making fast decisions with imperfect data? How do you get comfortable with that? And the second one is, like, how often do people go, hell yeah, I'd wire today?
Not often enough. And the reality is that how do you get comfortable with quick decisions is, I think you just start thinking more and more about the history of what were the common themes about things that have worked. And are enough of those common themes in this deal to take the bet? You also have built-in risk mitigation, which is investment size. Like, one of the beauties of Insight is, even though we have this really large fund, while our fund has gone up, whatever it is, 10 times, our median deal size has gone up like 30-40%. And so we have the natural ability to risk mitigate by just writing a smaller check. And so I think that it's really, really trying to focus on what's the core thesis and what are the real facts that we need to know, the core thesis. The problem is, there's always a way to get more information. And by the way, I don't think if you're asking whether or not we've perfected it, we definitely haven't. By the way, this is something I think the Tigers credit. I think they do well. I mean, I think they take more of a kind of a macro bet on a market. They do a lot of outside-in work, and they decide that they like the macro and they like what that company's market position in as they take the bet.
Yeah, I don't think anyone could fault them for speed of decision-making.
Correct.
Okay, we said the hell yeah to the would you wire the money today. What was the most recent hell yeah that you made and then obviously subsequently made the investment on? And why did you feel the hell yeah?
The most recent one that I've done is a company called TetraScience. TetraScience, if you think about, Veeva is to Snowflake, TetraScience would be to Snowflake. So it's kind of verticalized data around the life sciences category. If you think about a category that I think is going to have the same type of growth over the next 10 to 20 years and has had the same type, if not more, Moore's Law effects, it's life sciences, biotech, pharma. I mean, just think about how quickly we got a vaccine. Couldn't imagine that 10 or 15 years ago. And so I think that industry is going to see just an incredible amount of innovation. And I think TetraScience is one of the more exciting software bets around that category. But as a firm, we've probably made 7 or 8 different bets around different software applications, different layers of the pharma life sciences industry.
Devin, been so much fun doing this, and I just can't thank you enough for giving up your time today.
Thank you.
I just love that discussion. I want to say a huge thank you to Devin for being so open with my very wayward questions. If you'd like to see more from us behind the scenes, you can, of course, on the20minutevc.com. I always love to see you there. But before we leave you today, did you know that more than 80% of US public stock is owned by just 10% of Americans? This divide is even greater in the private markets. Carta makes it as easy to issue equity to your employees as it is to issue payroll, and for employees, as easy to accept it too. More than 16,000 companies issue equity to their employees through Carta. Whether you're just getting started or getting ready to go public, the team at Carta can help. Check them out at carta.com. And then another incredible product you have to introduce is SecureFrame. SecureFrame helps companies get enterprise ready by streamlining SOC 2 and ISO 27001 compliance. SecureFrame allows companies to get compliant within weeks rather than the painful months that it is today. Join companies like Stream, Hasura, Benepass, and unlock more sales with SecureFrame. And 20VC listeners get 10% off at SecureFrame.com.
timeframe.com/20VC. And finally, I've always been a big history fan, and so I want to talk about Cooley, the global law firm built around startups and venture capital. Since forming the very first venture fund in Silicon Valley, Cooley's formed more venture capital funds than any other law firm in the world, with 50 plus years working with VCs. They help VCs form and manage funds, make investments, and handle the myriad of issues that arise throughout a fund's lifetime. So to learn more about the number one most active law firm representing VC-backed companies going public, head over to Cooley.com and also check out CooleyGo.com.
As always, I so appreciate all your support, and I can't wait to bring you a fantastic set of episodes next week.